And I am the one that I am Casper, put in charge of hosting Mr. Mullins and try to make him stay as comfortable as possible. In order to give as much time as possible to our guest speaker for this evening, the introduction and the thank you at the end will be kept to a very bare minimum, thereby allowing you more time for questions at the end, followed by socializing with coffee, tea, cheese, and crackers, at which time our guest will autograph your books. Now, on to our guest. Many of you have met him before, and even more of you have read his books. He has been an investigative researcher for over 40 years. He has written countless articles, several books. His latest one is entitled The Rape of Justice. He is the only person ever fired from his post at the Library of Congress for his political views. And he's also the only writer who has had a book burned in Europe since 1945. He is a veteran of the United States Army Air Force with 36 months of active duty during the Second World War. He has been a resident of Staunton, Virginia for many years and comes to us at the end of a speaking engagement tour that took him from Virginia to San Francisco to Portland, from where he arrived this afternoon. Tomorrow he is headed for Salmon Arm before heading for Florida by the weekend. Only after this will he return home for a well-deserved rest. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Mr. Eustache Mullins.
I want to thank you all for turning out this evening to help us celebrate May Day. But I do have to apologize because my big picture of Lenin apparently did not arrive, so we'll have to go ahead and proceed without it. I do have a slight complaint coming from the lower 48 states, or 50 states or so, that from Canada, a very pernicious influence has been coming down to plague us in the States, and that is that you've been sending down your Bellsbergs and your Reichmans and your Brockmans to buy up all of our companies, and of course this is creating quite an economic crisis in our country. But I do realize, and you probably do also, that these are not really Canadians as we think of them. Rather, they are just more stooges of the House of Rothschild. Not many people know, and I have in my book, The World Order, traced the origin of these sudden billionaires who come here to Canada and all at once they're billionaires, and this is because they have the enormous capital resources of the World Zionist Organization and the House of Rothschild behind them, and that is why almost overnight they suddenly own enormous amounts of real estate. They buy up companies here in Canada as well as in the United States. Now, I became interested in anti-communist work through a mentor, a very well-known writer and the leading literary figure of the 20th century, the poet Ezra Pound. Now, I met Ezra Pound, who was being held as a political prisoner in an insane asylum. And Ezra Pound spent 13 and a half years without trial, without ever being sentenced, because he had broadcast over the radio such really insane statements as debt is slavery and taxation is robbery. Now you can understand why a person who would say things like that would have to be put in an insane asylum and to stay there for 13 and a half years without trial. And I was finally instrumental in getting Ezra Pound released from this institution, whereupon the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Mr. J. Edgar Hoover, who himself posed as a great anti-communist, a reputation which had absolutely no basis in fact, after I obtained the liberation of Ezra Pound, J. Edgar Hoover ordered his four top assistant directors of the FBI that I should be committed to a mental institution. the fact that he had no basis to do this did not bother him at all. He simply issued the order, and his mediums were supposed to put it into effect, which they proceeded to do. But when they came to my Chicago apartment to pick me up and bring me before a complacent Chicago judge who would then put me in an institution, I had gone to a little town in Michigan called Acosta, Michigan, to write the authorized biography of Ezra Pound. And of course, at that time, I never told anyone where I was going. I got in my car, I went from Chicago to Acosta. No one had any idea where I was. So when the FBI agents came to my apartment in Chicago, I was not there. Well, of course, they had to call up J. Edgar Hoover and give him this news. And they were very reluctant to do it, but they had to make the report. And of course, J. Edgar Hoover responded with total panic. He decided, because he was very mentally unstable himself, as was documented at that time, J. Edgar Hoover decided that I was on my way to Washington to kill him. So he issued a national alert for me. He had FBI agents stationed at every airport, every railway station, and every bus station in the United States to pick me up and to stop me from coming to Washington to finish him off. At that time, I was sitting in a little cabin in a lake in Michigan, typing up my book about Ezra Pound. I had no knowledge of any of this until 30 years later, when I got my FBI file through the Freedom of Information. And I reproduced 120 pages of that file in my book, A Writ for Martyrs. I also went to court against the FBI and filed suit against them for $35 million because this was, of course, a terrible invasion of my privacy and a conspiracy to injure me by federal agents under the guise of carrying out their official duties. So we went into federal court on this lawsuit, and the FBI failed to respond. So I had a default judgment entered on the books for $35 million. And in the States, when you get a default judgment, it becomes a matter of record. It cannot be expunged. It's a permanent debt. But then you have to get a federal judge to give you an order of execution to collect this money. Well, I bided my time, and I didn't do anything about it for a while. So then, because they had not answered the first suit, I refiled the suit for $50 million. Once again, they failed to answer on time, and I entered the default judgment for $50 million in the federal court. I now have two default judgments totaling $85 million, which I thought would be a very comfortable nest egg for my old age. And so I'm still counting on that, because I saw one of the best lawyers in the United States in Florida recently, Dr. Edwin Vieira. And Dr. Vieira was one of Lyndon LaRouche's lawyers, and he has written a book called Pieces of Eight, A History of the Money of the United States. So I said, Ed, what about this $85 million that I have on the books? Can I collect that? Is that a good judgment? He said, absolutely. He said, those default judgments, once they're entered on the books, he said, there's absolutely nothing they can do except for a federal judge to order them to pay it up. So I'm still holding on to that. And in my book, The Rape of Justice, I detail many legal techniques which any citizen of Canada or the United States can use to protect any infringement on their liberties. Now, I myself have continued to suffer from various forms of censorship. My book, Murder by Injection, a lady went to the Tulsa, Oklahoma library recently, and she said, you should have this book on your shelf. Well, the book had been circulating for quite a while. It had been reviewed, and no one had challenged anything in the book. But the library people in Oklahoma decided that they had better be cautious about this. There might be something wrong with this book, which they never do. They appointed a review committee to read my book and to see if it would be suitable for circulation to the people of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Well, they studied the book, they went through it from cover to cover, and then the director, Pat Woodrum, made a report. She said, the reviewers found that the book is primarily an attack on the medical community, the Rockefeller Foundation, the American Cancer Society, the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the fluoridation of water, and the vaccination against polio. Based on the reviews by the committee, the book will not be added to the library collection. So you see, we have plenty of censorship in the United States. I was the victim of another bit of censorship recently. When I left here, I was supposed to deliver the annual memorial address for Senator Joe McCarthy in Appleton, Wisconsin on May 6th. I'd been invited there by the Memorial Foundation, and because it has recently been taken over by the John Birch Society, a member of the foundation called me the other night, and he said, Mr. Mullins, we do not want you, we cannot have you speak at Joe McCarthy's memorial. Now, the paradox of this is that I worked for Joe McCarthy during the height of his anti-communist crusade in Washington. I gave him the information on the financial origins of communism, which he delivered in a speech before the Chicago Club, and which brought him more active political support than he had had up to that time. And of course, I have been and am still a great admirer of Senator Joe McCarthy, because at one time Joe McCarthy stood at the very door of the White House. He had only to lift his finger, and he could have walked in and said, I am now the president, and he could have kicked these communist rats right out of our bureaucratic system. But Joe McCarthy did not do that. He was a good party member of the Republican Party, and he let them steamroller him out of his crusade against communism. So I wanted to come there to Appleton, Wisconsin, and in his memory, remind people of what Joe McCarthy had done for the people of the United States. Now here come these censors, come in sneaking in the dark, and saying, no, you cannot come. Well, I had intended to go anyway, but then I remembered that I had another engagement in Florida on the same day, and there was no way I could do it. But this shows you the kind of stealthy attack against patriots anywhere in this continent. There are forces, subversive forces, which work behind the scenes and which try to stop anyone who sincerely opposes the subversive work of the Communist Party. Now, I also would like to indulge in a little racism here tonight. I know that racism is a terrible crime, and I'm going to read you a little something here from the New York Times, quoting the Prime Minister of Japan. He said to a group of his party's leading politicians, in a highly developed informational society, in a highly educated society such as Japan, the people require politics that bravely face problems. In the United States, because there are considerable numbers of blacks, Puerto Ricans, and Mexicans, the intellectual level is lower. So this is why American people are driving Japanese cars instead of American cars, because we no longer have the productive capacity. We are rapidly becoming a third world country. When I left California yesterday, the newspapers had stated that by the end of this century, which is less than a decade away, that white people will be outnumbered in the state of California by minorities, and they themselves will be a minority. And this is the shadow which hangs over all of this continent of North America today. You're seeing it here in Vancouver, you're seeing it in Toronto, we're seeing it all over the United States. And this is something that we have to decide. At what point are we going to resist becoming a third world country? At what point are we going to renew our origins and restore our traditional form of government? Now, the other things that I have written about in recent years, I had mentioned the murder by injection. I have a chapter in there on fluoridation. And after I finished that book, I received this Dickinson statement from Australia, and here is a letter from the United States Environmental Protection Agency, dated March 30th, 1983, in which the Deputy Administrator of the EPA for Water says, in regard to the use of fluosilicic acid as a source of fluoride for fluoridation, this agency regards such use as an ideal environmental solution to a long-standing problem. By recovering byproduct fluosilicic acid from fertilizer manufacturing, water and air pollution are minimized, and water utilities have a low-cost source of fluoride available to them. Now, what you have there is a bureaucrat stating that because the corporations have a disposal problem of disposing of their excess quantities of their byproduct sodium fluoride, that the ideal situation is to put it in our drinking water. And this is the official position of a bureaucrat in the city of Washington, D.C. today. This is what they have done. They have put the fluoride in the water. As what the fluoride does is to attack the immune system. It lowers your resistance against any disease. Some authorities say that the AIDS epidemic itself is directly traceable to the fluoridation of water. Of course, I don't drink the fluoridated water myself because as a senior citizen, at my age, the sodium fluoride would accumulate in my kidneys, my liver, it would attack my heart, and most people my age who've been drinking fluoridated water are already dead because the system cannot continue to absorb this cumulative poison over a period of years. And remember that they fluoridated the water in the States almost 40 years ago. In my little town of Stanton, Virginia, my brother appeared at a hearing to oppose the fluoridating of the city water. He was joined by the head of the Department of Chemistry of a local college, and they, in turn, were opposed by spokesmen from Washington, from the United States Public Health Service, who unhesitatingly endorsed the fluoridation of drinking water for all people. So, because of this official endorsement, the city put fluoride in the water in Stanton, Virginia in 1952. And a few months later, the head of the Department of Chemistry's contract came up for renewal at the college, and they did not renew his contract. He no longer had a job. And as far as I know, he may not even have a job today. Now, I want to tell you how the Public Health Service became the great endorser of fluoridation of water. This was done by a very old and simple scientific technique. It was done by the aluminum company giving a $750,000 bribe to the head of the Public Health Service. And he then sent the bureaucrats of the Public Health Service out across the United States to tell the communities that they had to use fluoride in their drinking water, that the government had endorsed it, that it was a health measure. The fact that it was compulsory medication, the fact that dictatorships in Europe, such as the Soviet Union, had long known that fluoridating water in the concentration camps was the easiest method of pacifying the prisoners, of keeping them docile, and preventing any likelihood that they would revolt against their guards. And this communist technique is what we got in this country when they fluoridated our drinking water. I have the actual photographs of our congressional record here, which is our official record of our Congress deliberations, in which the Honorable Adolph Miller of Nebraska in the House of Representatives, he exposed the $750,000 bribe. He said that at one point he, as a physician, had thought that perhaps fluoridating the water would help the children. And then he said, when he looked at the so-called scientific studies which recommended the fluoridation of water, he found that they all quoted each other. He could not find a single reliable study which itself had come to any conclusion. All these people did was to copy each other's recommendations. And they chose a concentration in the water of one part per million, and which they now know is too high. A tenth of that would be adequate, but They chose that concentration without any scientific validity whatsoever. The Oscar Ewing, the man who had accepted the $750,000 bribe, they came to him as the head of the Public Health Service, and they said, Mr. Ewing, we could put 0.1%, or we could put one part per million, or we can put 0.5 parts per million, or we can put 5 parts per million. So he more or less flipped a coin and said, well, we'll go with 1 part per million, and that's what we've had now for almost 40 years, 1 part per million of fluoride in the drinking water. And we know now, the scientists know, that that concentration is devastating, especially to older citizens. Perhaps this is the what they call the final solution of the growing number of older people, because the fluoridated water will sooner or later take care of that situation. Oscar Ewing himself, by a paradox, was also the man who was in charge of the confinement of Ezra Pound, the man who introduced me to the anti-communist struggle. Ezra Pound was held at St. Elizabeth's Hospital under the aegis of the Federal Security Agency, and Oscar Ewing just happened to be the head of the Federal Security Agency as well as the Public Health Service, which is a subsidiary. So this is how we got fluoridated water, and this is how we get these other so-called benefits from the bureaucracy in our capital. Now, in my political and legal work over the years, I had to go to court many times. I had to go alone. When I first went into court, I had no idea. I thought, well, you go into court and you state your case, and if you have a good case, why, the judge will recognize the validity of your evidence. He'll say, well, you've got your right, and so I'm going to rule in your favor. And over 40 years of appearing in courts, I never had that happen once. And it took me over 30 years to find out exactly what I was up against. What I finally discovered, and I have it in the Rape of Justice, and I have it in the Curse of Canaan also, is that the legal system, both here in Canada and in the United States, is the old cabalistic system, which goes back 5,000 years. Now, the cabalistic system is a mystical system based on numbers, and our whole legal system, which supposedly has case histories, precedents, statutes, none of this really applies when you get into court, because you're up against a supernatural force. In fact, the head of the Columbia Law School himself, I had the Dr. Felix Cohen in the Harper's Monthly of 1934, February, he said the due process of law itself is nothing but transcendental nonsense. And here is one of the leading authorities in the United States, and other people have said the same thing. We had a professor at Yale Law School, Fred Rodell, who has written a book called Woe Unto You Lawyers. And he calls lawyers purveyors of streamlined voodoo and chromium-plated theology. He said law is merely a high-class racket. Well, I found that out the hard way, because, as I say, when I went into courts, I did not know that this was a cabalistic system. I did not know. I did not know that our legal safeguards had been entirely bypassed, that we were under a martial law system of admiralty law, in which the admiral has some life or death power over anyone who's under jurisdiction. Now, this is understandable on a ship at sea, where the admiral has to maintain control of the crew, and that is why admiralty law has such powers over the individual. Those powers have now been transferred in toto into our courts, and when you come under the jurisdiction of a court, you are coming under the jurisdiction of admiralty law, and you have absolutely no individual rights whatsoever. This is why the judges can hand down such stunning decisions, such violations of our rights, and we don't understand. We say, how can they do this? We say, they can't do this, but they've already done it. I've had friends marched off to jail for 10 years for minor infractions of some regulation or other, and when they went into court, they had no idea of the fate that faced them, because they knew the law, they knew their situation, they presented their case, and they wound up going to prison for 10 years. There are two principal dangers when you go into a court under the Kabbalistic system. The first is that if you're right and you know you're right, that is the most dangerous of all, because you believe that because you're right, you're going to receive justice, that the court is going to recognize the rights of your case, and that you really have nothing to worry about. And that's when you get steamrolled. The second most dangerous thing is to trust your lawyer, because when you trust your lawyer, you are going down the drain. I was assured in one case, which I had been negotiating for 3 years in court, it was a traffic injury case that where a man tried to kill me by ramming my car, and I sued him, and the decision, he had been chosen to do this, by the way, and this is not paranoia on my part, it was told to me by someone who was there. They had a meeting at the synagogue, and they said, "What are we going to do about Eustace Mullins?" And this man, a local merchant, said, "Well, I'll take care of Eustace Mullins." So the next thing I know, this man is charging at me in a big black Lincoln, and he slams into my car. And the only reason I survived was that my car was as big and heavy as his. I'd been in a small car and had been killed. So then I had to sue him for the damages. He hired the most expensive law firm in the city. This was a law firm, I found out later, which had very close connections with the Central Intelligence Agency and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So instead of simply suing a local merchant, I was up against the whole Washington bureaucracy. And I didn't know that for over a year. So after this case had gone on for some time, and I thought we should negotiate a settlement of some sort, I was willing to do that. Although I was representing myself, and it wasn't costing me very much money. So the judge said to me, "Mr. Mullins," he said, "the lawyers are willing to negotiate, but they don't want to negotiate with you because you're not an attorney." Well, that's when I should have told him it was full of nonsense, but I thought, well, I want to be reasonable. This is also a very bad mistake. Don't ever be reasonable in any court, because the people you're dealing with are not reasonable.
Right.
They're not reasonable. They do not recognize reason. They're Kabbalistic, mystical chanters of prayers, and they're not going to listen to reason. So when he told me, he said, "If you will hire a lawyer, that lawyer will negotiate with this man's lawyers, and you will get your settlement." Well, I believed him, and I went and hired a lawyer. I had difficulty hiring a lawyer at first, because I had already sued a number of lawyers in that area. We had about 12 lawyers in the area, and I'd sued about 8 of them. Now, this is something that I recommend highly to any one of you. Don't ever overlook the possibility of suing a lawyer, because they're very vulnerable. And the minute you file a suit against them, their malpractice insurance doubles, which costs them thousands of dollars a year. And as one lawyer in San Francisco, Edward Freeberg, said, because he has made a specialty of suing lawyers for clients and obtaining million-dollar damage judgments against them, he said, lawyers are ideal people to sue, because he said, juries hate lawyers. So when you go before a jury and you're suing a lawyer, that jury is going to say, "My gosh, this is a chance to strike at one of these crooks," and they'll rule for you. You have a very good chance on that. So I hired this lawyer, and he turned out to be totally inept and totally crooked. The first thing he did was we went before the court, and he agreed that I should pay $400 for a witness of this man that tried to kill me. He and his wife were in the car, and later on he claimed that his sister-in-law had been in the back seat. At that time, his sister-in-law was attending a Hadassah meeting 500 miles away. But they made me pay that $400 for her witness, even though she was never near the scene of the accident. So as soon as he did that, I fired him the same day. Then I had to go back before the court, and they found a black alcoholic whom they claimed had seen the accident and said it was my fault. But before they could bring this black alcoholic into court, he was committed to a local insane asylum. Now, this is the only witness against me. Now this whole thing sounds like absolute nonsense, which is what it was. So when we go into court, they had a deposition from this black alcoholic. And so they thought they were going to steamroller me into letting the deposition be read to the jury. So I said to the judge, I said, this is the only witness in this case. I had a witness, the policeman who came and reviewed the accident and took down the information, but 3 days before he went to trial, this policeman, 38 years old, died suddenly in a local hospital. And people used to ask me what he died of, and I said, well, he died of medical treatment. What do people usually die of? So anyway, my witness was gone. They were going to put the deposition of the black alcoholic before the jury. I objected, and the judge had no recourse but to send down to the insane asylum and bring the black alcoholic up to testify with two armed guards to protect him. So this whole thing had gotten so ludicrous that the judge then declared a mistrial against me. When they brought the black alcoholic in before he could testify, they declared a mistrial. So we went through that process again at another trial, and this man had hit my car in the side, smashed in my two side doors, and at the trial, the judge had the jury go out with me and look at my car and see the two smashed in side doors. The jury came back and deliberated 8 minutes and declared that I had backed my car into the front of his car, and therefore they found for the defendant. Now, this was a typical case that I've had over the years in American courts. And this is what you get in the courts. Now, I don't care how ludicrous it is. And the reason they can get away with these things is because the courts are under martial law. And because you do not have any legal system functioning whatsoever. I used to go into judges' chambers and I would have motions which I had prepared and researched. And they would be motions of 8 or 10 pages long. And the judge would not even have read the motions. We would sit there and he'd read the motion, and then he would say to me, Mr. Mullins, he says, you're right on the case law, and you're right on the statutes, but I am going to exercise my judicial discretion and rule against you anyway. And when they exercise judicial discretion, that is the martial law. That is the captain of the ship saying, I don't care what the case is, I'm going under martial law, I can rule against you. And that's what they would do. And at that time, I did not know it was martial law, or I would objected on those grounds. Now, when I go into court, if this comes up again, I will say, Your Honor, will you state for the record that we are using admiralty court procedures in this court? Now, they will never do that. They will dismiss the case before they will do that. I haven't done it yet, but I haven't had a case in court for a year or so because I've been too busy writing books. I said the other day, my practice has gone with dogs. But people used to ask me, why do you represent yourself? And they would cite the old adage that a man who represents himself in court has a fool for a lawyer. Well, I had seen a lot of fools who were lawyers, and so I said, I have to update that, and I have to let the people know that the way that reads today is, a man who hires a lawyer is a fool. And I'll stick by that. I have excellent background by my location in Virginia for doing the kind of work that I'm doing, because I live in a small town which boasts of two of the greatest criminals of the 20th century. I live on one hill and I look across to another hill and I can see the birthplace of President Woodrow Wilson, who led this country in the First World War and who tried to put us under the dictatorship of the League of Nations. And he did all this under the influence of a mysterious man named Colonel Edward Mandel House. Colonel House's father had been the principal agent for the House of Rothschild in Texas during the Civil War. He made a fortune running the blockade because the Rothschild ships could go through when no other ships would be sunk. The U.S. Navy was sitting out there, and if these southern ships with cotton tried to get through to go to England, they would be blown out of the water. But Mr. House's Rothschild ships would sail through it, go right on to England. They would get payment in gold. They'd bring that gold back to Mr. House. And at the end of the Civil War, Mr. House, the Rothschild agent, was the only person in Texas who had any cash money. And with that cash money, he totally ruled the selection of political candidates in the state of Texas from 1870 until 1914. And at that time, his son, Colonel Edward House, became a major factor in the Democratic Party. He came to Washington, he managed the campaign of Woodrow Wilson, he moved right in and became Woodrow Wilson's supposedly right-hand man. In fact, Colonel House was the go-between of Woodrow Wilson and the House of Rothschild in London. And his partner in that endeavor was a Colonel William Wiseman of London, who at the end of the First World War became a partner of Kunlow Company of New York, which was the official agent of the House of Rothschild in the United States. And Kunlow Company was headed by Jacob Schiff, who had been born in Frankfurt, Germany, in the Rothschild house itself, and had been sent to the United States to represent that firm here. Jacob Schiff put up $28 million of his own money to finance the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And this firm controlled 90% of the railway mileage in the United States. They would give him special rebates on his oil, and with those railroad rebates, he could undercut any other refiner in the United States. The result of that arrangement, which was called the Southern Improvement Company, which is a matter of record, was that John D. Rockefeller erected Standard Oil Company as the greatest monopoly in the world. And with that monopoly, he set up in 1913 the Rockefeller Foundation, which I fully exposed in my book, The World Order, and in the Murder by Injection. I looked up the total history of every director and official of the Rockefeller Foundation, this great charitable organization. I checked out every affiliation of every one of the people who had been held important positions in the Rockefeller Foundation since 1913. I found out that not one of them had any background in any charitable endeavor. These people were specialists in chemical warfare. They knew how to manufacture poison gas, bombs, armaments. Not one of them had ever had any experience in any charitable enterprise, and yet they were presented to the world as great philanthropists. You know, Henry Thoreau, in his book Walden, he said, "If I were to be informed that a man was coming to my house to try to do me good, I would run for my life," because he said there is nothing more dangerous than a philanthropist. And when I went to the Library of Congress and I looked up the original charters of all of the big foundations, such as the Rockefeller Foundation, Russell Sage Foundation, I traced them back to one man named Daniel Coit Gilman, who had been educated in Germany, who had been indoctrinated into the German Illuminati, and who had come back to this country and set up a fraternity at Yale, which was called Skull and Bones. Now, the reason it was called Skull and Bones was, as an Illuminati initiation rite, the person, the student, only seniors were chosen, and they had the script and get into a coffin, and then they set some mumbo jumbo over them, and they arose, and they were supposedly reborn as a new person, totally controlled by this Illuminati organization. This was the origin of the entire fraternal group known as the Skull and Bones. At the present time, we have a president of the United States named George Bush, who is a member of Skull and Bones, who went through this initiation rite. His family banking house, the Brown Brothers Hiram Company, was the representative of the Bank of England in the United States, and every member of Brown Brothers Harriman for the past 80 years has been a member of this very exclusive fraternity at Yale University. Now, there are only 15 members chosen each year, so you can see how exclusive it is. I had a friend who went to Yale University, and I asked him about Skull and Bones. He said it was well known on the campus that if you were tapped for bones, you were set for life, that you would never have to worry about money or career again in your lifetime. That is true, because once you become a member of this fraternity, you become a president of a corporation, you become a president of a bank, or you become president of the United States. Because it is a German Illuminati group, and because it gives you access to the total power of the world order and the world conspiracy. And because we citizens have no knowledge or little knowledge of what is going on and what we're up against, and we have to become informed on these things. I have spent 40 years. I was very fortunate to meet Ezra Pound, who turned over to me some 30 years of research which he had already put into this very subject. Ezra Pound was a poet, but he became interested in this situation because the artist colony that he lived in London in 1910, 1912, over half of the young artists that he had, writers that he knew, became cannon fodder and were killed during the First World War. And at that time, Ezra Pound thought, well, I'd like to find out what happened. How did this war start? Well, when he began to look into it, he couldn't find any real political or economic reason for the First World War. We know that Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated at Sarajevo, and I have the full story of that in The Curse of Canaan. That was a Masonic conspiracy. Ferdinand was killed because the Masons wanted to unleash a world war of people to the world. And this is exactly what they did. They carried out their program. No one at that time knew what was going on. It took Ezra Pound 30 years to even get an inkling of forces that were at work behind the scenes. And it took me another 40 years to put the details in the jigsaw puzzle and to present it in a form which other people could use. Now, I do tell people that you can take my books into court. Lawyers are presenting them in court as legal briefs because I have documented everything. I've spent a long time putting this material together, and I put it together so that other people can use it. These are not books just to read. These are books which you can use to work with and to formulate your own programs and to try to restore Western civilization. And I hope that you will do that, and I am going to continue. I'm working. I'm getting out a book every year. I'm doing one now, which is an expose of our educational system, which I call The Child Molesters. Because what we are seeing here is at a time, a very crucial period in our culture, we are sacrificing an entire generation to the satanic influences which go back 5,000 years, the ritual sacrifice of children, and I have all the documentation of that in my book, The Curse of Canaan. And I start with the Bible and I bring it right up to date. The entire secular humanistic movement is part of the cult of Baal, which goes back to Babylon. I trace that all through the Middle Ages, bring it right up through the wars and right to the present day. Because once you get on the track, you begin to see the same influences, the same satanic philosophy at work throughout the centuries. They use the same techniques. You can see the same people at work. And that is where we are today, that we have to come to grips with these forces. They are determined to destroy us, but they also are very vulnerable because they can exist only in the darkness. Once the light is shed upon them, they lose their power and they begin to disappear. I believe we are now at that point in history where the light of Christ will shine upon these people and will destroy them and remove their malign influence forever from our history. Thank you.
watchman in the bedroom to a very bare minimum. I took several notes while at the table, but after such an enlightening talk, I had to simply write them up, because all were so interesting that truly, well, all I can say is very much of a heartfelt thank you for all the points you have brought. And most of the points I know relate to all of us here in one way or another. So I think I will simply again say thank you very much for the beautiful talk, and the floor is open to all the questions after which time that Mr. Kahn is said. Thank you.
Well, as you know, some speakers are very reluctant to answer general questions. They ask that people write them out, and they bring them up, and they read them, and then they decide whether they want to answer them or not. I don't do that. I mean, if you have a question, I answer it to the best of my ability. So I'll be glad to hear from any of you. Gentlemen, in back.
Mr. Paul, you wrote a little order you gave that from 1990 to the year 2000. You compared to North Bay, one of the great clock tables down in the building. They took 500,000 Chinese, and they were armed in black of Africa, and bring to Africa to the state of Rothschild attitude to the place where they hold ivory and slave trade. What I'm saying is, you think Europe and North America are the clock tables you brought down. You don't think not too specific what will happen to the West Green Center. They'll bring it down by plague, or see if they aren't black, be possibly too devastating to the best of the environment. So how are they going to preserve the environment that brings the population down, because the parasites have to want to preserve the environment? And what is the future of the White Green context of the world?
Well, I wrote that prediction in 1985, 5 years ago. And since then, of course, the historical trends have changed slightly, because you do have the AIDS epidemic in Africa, which would change that slightly. But I still believe that we're coming into a period where they definitely are going to try to drastically reduce the world population. I spoke this weekend at a meeting in San Francisco called the Whole Life Exposition, and a friend and I got in there under sort of false pretenses, because we were the only conservatives there and over 800 exhibitors, and most of them were like a third world bazaar. You had all of these booths of crystals and perfume and incense. It was entirely a new age deal. And the two gurus of the whole thing were Dr. Timothy Leary and a lady named Barbara Marx. Now, Barbara Marx's pitch is that in order to get the world that we want, there are going to be a certain number of dissidents, which she puts at about 25% of the world population. So she states very frankly that in order to do what they want to do, they're going to eliminate one-fourth of the world's population. Dr. Timothy Leary tried to get an entire generation of college students onto drugs. He succeeded to a great extent. He's the only professor who was ever fired from Harvard, as far as I know. And the interesting thing is that Dr. Leary, whom I'd seen on television a number of times, I went into the speaker's lounge just before he'd go speak, and he was sitting there, and I didn't talk to him. But I noticed that he looked pretty decayed, and so he came out to speak, and I listened to him for a few minutes, and he was fumbling around, and you could see that his mind is about gone. I mean, LSD does not exactly improve your memory over 30 years. So I didn't listen to him for a few minutes, because he really was in very pathetic shape. And so I was in the laboratory sometime later, and there were two guys in there, and they were saying, I was so disappointed in Dr. Leary's speech, and so I couldn't help but chime in and say, well, I really think he's about gone. I think it's too bad. But he and Miss Barbara Marx were the two people that were featured. And Dr. Leary, when he spoke, he had about 600 people in the main auditorium listening to him. I spoke there the next day at the same time, and I had 35 people. So I hadn't had the advantage of being on television as much as Dr. Leary, but I did get on the Morton County show last July. And the upshot of that was that Castle Morton got his show. That has happened quite a few times. I've done one or two regular shows around the country a week on some television. And I would say over half of the people who have had me appear on their radio show, their radio shows have been canceled. I had one guy in Denver who has had me on three different times when he had a radio show. And each time his show would be canceled and he'd move to another station. But he didn't learn anything because he would invite me to come out again and do another show. And I would go. And I'd have dinner with him and we'd go do the show. And then the next week he'd be canceled and he'd be looking for another station. So he went through that three times, but he had persistence. I'll give him that. But this does happen about half the time when I appear. And I don't say anything which anybody can challenge. I don't say anything which is not documented in my books, my research. But still, so much pressure is put on these people that the show is just canceled. And this is a situation which cannot go on forever, because when they have to come out in the open and boldly cancel a show because they've had somebody on and dare to speak the truth, sooner or later people are going to say, well, we can't put up with much more of this. We've got to have some control over this media. We've got to allow some truth to get to the people. And I think we're at that point now where we have almost an underground radio system in this country. We have the cable networks coming up, and they allow open access. I have done many television shows, 1 and 2 hours on cable access shows in Dallas, Milwaukee, and other cities. And on that cable access, they show those things over and over again. They show them to college audiences, and they do reach a lot of people. So there is an educational process going on, and I feel that we're reaching more and more people. I know over the past 40 years, people have said to me, how can you go on doing what you're doing, knowing what you know? Why aren't you in total despair? I say, I've never been in despair for 1 minute. I've seen some dark days. But work is so interesting that I couldn't do anything else if I wanted to. And it gets more fascinating all the time as I begin to put more and more pieces of the puzzle together. And after about 25 years, I was working over and over again with the same names, which I already knew. So things got easier as I went along. And it has become very interesting and very rewarding. So I hope that answered your question. The gentleman right here. Well, the Federal Reserve System today is being run by a man named Greenblatt, out in Greensboro. And he's a partner of J.P. Morgan Company. J.P. Morgan Company was represented at the original conspiratory meeting in January 1910 in Jekyll Island, Georgia, when they secretly drafted the Federal Reserve Act. So the same people have been running it ever since. And the world debt structure itself at the present time is so top heavy, it could collapse at any time. What they're going through now is what they call a continuous rollover. A continuous rollover is when interest payments and liabilities become due, they find some arcane method of keeping it going for another 6 weeks or 3 months. And they just keep doing this, and sooner or later they're going to get caught short. Because there's practically no cash flow going on at the present time. It's just paper shuffling. And one day, a note for $2 billion is not going to get to the bank before it closes, and the whole thing is going to go down the drain. But that's the system that we have at the present time. And when people think, well, when a monetary system collapses, that's the end of everything. But actually, it's like a war or any other calamity. That's when you rebuild. That's where we are at the present time. We have got to think not of the problems, the crisis that we have. We have got to think, how are we going to rebuild and how are we going to go on? And we will go on, because we're not just going to give up, because the bankers have created an impossible situation in their greed for profit and their struggle to control all the nations of the world. And we're simply going to
get rid of that system, and we're going to build a sound spectrum, because we can do it. Gold remains a very standard of monetary measurement throughout the world. It always has been. Even when nations go off the gold standard, you know, we closed the gold window in 1971 under President Nixon, but the world banking system continues to use gold as a standard of value even when they're not on the gold standard, because the assets that they have are still denominated to some extent in gold. So therefore, because you still have a reputable standard of value, the whole thing cannot totally collapse, because you're going to have, that probably would be your basis for rebuilding, is the even minuscule reference to gold, which is in the world of monetary structures. Yes?
In your judgment, is that the reason that they
I think so. I don't think they're doing much about AIDS whatsoever. And what is happening is it's becoming another government boom dollar. Well, they're spending billions and billions of dollars, but it's all going, it's all being pocketed by somebody, and it's not, it has practically no reference to any solution to the problem. And I think that's very deliberate. Yes.
Great research that is going to have in some years before the number of people. They did a pretty good job.
Oh, yes. In fact, I'll be speaking for the branch of the Christian Heritage Research Group in Cape Canaveral, Florida, in about 2 weeks. I've spoken there several times, and they do have some very good chapters and are doing very good work. Maybe not.
John Birch Society, the students have their field. I'm gathered by his life that he felt that this was a society that was reflective.
The society is not disreputable. It misleads people because it tries to convince people that it's a sincere anti-communist organization, but it actually does nothing toward that end. It gets people in and it gives them a little literature and they meet for week meetings, but nothing happens. And also, the John Birch Society refuses to have any contact or use any books or writings of people like myself. There are many writers like myself whom the John Birch Society will not allow their members to read. They'll even tell them, don't read these despondent works and so forth. And people ask, well, I'd like to read his books. I've read his books. I think they're good. And their chapter leader will say, well, we're instructed not to allow those books on our website. But even so, the American Penny bookstores, which are the John Birch Society bookstores, many of them do carry my books because they're independently owned and the John Birch Society cannot prevent them from carrying my books. They order my books and sell them. But the Birch Society itself refuses to mention my name in any of its publications, even though their biggest seller that they ever had, which was Gary Allen's Nuntar Calling Conspiracy, were based directly on my Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and I have letters from Gary Allen stating that. He ordered my books, and he studied my books, and he wrote that book, and it was a very successful book, and I'm writing a book. He did give me attribution in the early editions. That was later deleted, and now it's being peddled by a guy named Larry Abraham. It's a total phony, and because the Birch Society has been affiliated with so many people like this, and its founder, Robert Welch, was actually a failed candy salesman. That's all he ever did in life, to sell candy. And the company went bankrupt, and he was taken in by his brother. The Welch Candy Company went back to his brother's company, and his brother put it back on his feet. From there, he went on to found the John Birch Society. But the society itself, in denying the invitation which had already been extended to speak there, shows the tactics that they use against anyone who is not a member of their particular little group. One of my closest friends, Remo Oliver, a great classical scholar in Urbana, Illinois, helped to found the John Birch Society after 3 years, he told Robert Welch, he said, what you're doing is entirely useless. The way you're going, it's a total loss, and I am not going to be a part of it and see the people any longer. So he said, I am resigning. So Robert Welch said, well, I'll give you $5,000 if you'll never tell anybody why you left the society. And when Dr. Revel Oliver said, well, I don't need your $5,000, and anyway, I would rather be free to speak if I want to, and he did, and he was very frank in his later writings about why he had left the Gettysburg Society. I have another friend, Bunker Hunt, who used to give him $1 million a year, and when Bunker Hunt fell upon financial difficulties for the last couple of years, they promptly took his name off of their letter game. So these are the kind of people you're dealing with. Gentlemen in the back.
Yeah, a lot of my wife and all mentioned this week. It's about bones that are in the originated in Germany. The light got on that, if that was German Christian origin or German Jewish origin. And if that is the second room, the light got this, got the light on that, and don't get the hardest thing to say.
Well, as you probably know, the Illuminati was founded by a German professor at Ingolstadt University named Adam Weishaupt. And the student who went to Germany and was indoctrinated in Illuminati techniques, Daniel Coit Gilman, was a member of an old New England family. When he came back to this country and he set up the Russell Trust, of which the Rotted Skull and Bones fraternity was later formed, it was not set up as a branch of the German Illuminati itself, but it was set up as a result of Daniel Coit Gilman's being commissioned to set up this particular organization in this country. And it's played a very vital role in our nation's history since 1848 when it was founded. For instance, William Buckley, who many people think of as a great conservative anti-communist, who publishes a magazine called the National Review, which many people think is a very good conservative publication. It's actually simply a CIA propaganda organ. Buckley has never had a job anywhere in his life except with the CIA. And it's part of the State of Israel propaganda group in New York and Washington, which took over the Republican Party under Ronald Reagan. Now this takes us into another area in which I've done a lot of work, and that is the fact that in the United States we have two political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, and they are both communist parties, but they are politically opposed because the Democratic Party is a Stalinist communist party, and the Republican Party is a Trotskyite communist party. So you see, Jimmy Carter was defeated by Ronald Reagan in 1980. The Stalinist communist Democrats were defeated by the Trotskyite communist Republicans. So people thought, oh, this is great. We have got a genuine anti-communist regime in Washington. And Reagan went on television and he denounced the Soviet Union as the evil empire. Well, the reason he did this was because these Trotskyite communists hated the Stalinist communists because Stalin had murdered Leon Trotsky in Mexico City in 1940. So what they wanted was revenge against Moscow for having murdered their leader. And that went on to the point of where these people were ready to go to war with Moscow to avenge the death of Leon Trotsky. The American people knew nothing of this. They thought, well, we do have these real anti-communists in there, and maybe they're going too far, and maybe we're not ready for war with Russia. But this is exactly what they were trying to do. And but, by the way, the new MO in Russia in recent years has been the final resurgence of the Trotskyite communists over the Stalinist communists. Gorbachev, the transitional figure, a Gorinsky type of Bolshevik, who is a go-between between the Trotskyite communists and the Stalinist communists. And because you have this dichotomy, how it's going to be resolved, I don't know, but I believe the Trotskyite communists, which are already a total power in Washington, are going to be a total power in Moscow. So this may be the prelude to the final merging of the Soviet Union with the North American democracies, which they've been planning for so many generations. Said he would do the public relations work and so forth, and they had raised about $20,000 for the campaign, and Larry Abraham took the $20,000 and walked off, and they never saw him again. So, and he's been doing this for years. He did move in on Gary Allen, and took Gary Allen died suddenly, and Larry Abraham took over his books. He's publishing them now under his own name. Then he set up a phony organization called Freedom Incorporated, with a promoter in Switzerland named Harry Schultz, who doesn't even dare come to the United States because he'd be arrested if he stays in Switzerland. So they publicized that they were going to make Freedom Incorporated a worldwide organization. And I think the idea was that if you wanted to enjoy freedom, you could purchase it from Larry Abraham. And so he's conned a lot of people on that. They travel around the world, they spend a lot of money. These are total confidence scam operations. So you mentioned the Marlon Maddox program, which is an interesting thing because my manager in Dallas got me on the Marlon Maddox program about 5 years ago. And I did a one-hour program, and Marlon Maddox liked it, and he had to do another one-hour program. And he has an audience of about 3 million people in what they call the Bible Belt throughout the southeastern United States. But what his listeners don't know is that Marlon Maddox is a Jew who tried to become a born-again Christian, but unfortunately it didn't take, and he wound up as a born-again Jew. So he's really a Jewish propagandist, and of course he has people like Larry Abraham on, and he won't have me on the show anymore, which is all right with me, because he sold my tapes for 2 years, tapes and shows, and I never got a nickel out of it. But then he said, no, I'm not going to have Mr. Smollett on anymore. And he has Larry Abraham on constantly, and I have tapes of their program in which Larry Abraham boasts that he is an agent of Mossad, Israeli intelligence, that he has highly placed friends in the Israel government, and that the Israelis are not socialists, that they're genuine anti-communists, and on and on. I have tapes of these things. I have published a 15-page article exposing Larry Abraham, which I call None Dare Call Him Traitor. And that has had very wide circulation over the last several years. I don't have the copies with me here tonight, but my manager in Dallas still circulates such copies. And so that pretty well tells you what Larry Abraham really is, because I have many in there, 15 pages tonight, many quotes from his actual broadcast with Marlon Maddox, in which they claim that the Rothschilds are behind the Council on Foreign Relations, and then they claim the Rothschilds have nothing to do with the State of Israel. Well, if you go to Tel Aviv, you drive down Rothschild Boulevard, and the Knesset, the Israeli Parliament, was entirely built with one donation from Baron James Rothschild, and he's buried there. And it's as though one person would have put up the money for building your whole parliament building in your nation's capital. So I exposed all of these lies and inconsistencies in Abraham's work. And of course, he has never answered to any of my charges, but he had one of his stooges, a writer named Tony Sutton, Anthony Sutton, say that he could not understand. Tony Sutton wrote in his newsletter, the Phoenix newsletter, he said, I know Eustace Smollett and I respect his work, but I cannot understand why he would attack a great patriot like Larry Abraham. And he said, it's this sort of thing which tears apart our movement and causes dissension, and I hope that Eustace Smollett will see the error of his ways. Well, I continue to circulate my pamphlet on Larry Abraham because I'm still waiting for him to respond to any of the documented charges which I have. But it's people like that that are sure poison and which prevent us from getting anywhere in this
business. Gentlemen, thanks for the information on that. I haven't got that info out in the meeting. I'm going to ask you for thanks for what you're
doing. Well, if you had been on this program and seen me, he calls his program the International Christian Network, even though it's composed of four Jews, himself, his wife, his son, and his daughter-in-law. They have a total staff. These four Jews are the total staff of the International Christian Radio Network. So I don't think they would hire a Christian on any sort of thing. Yes. Well, people always ask me what I think of Lyndon LaRouche. I think Lyndon LaRouche went a little too far and exposed an awful lot of things. Lyndon LaRouche has some very good information in his publications. He put a book out about 10 years ago called Dope Incorporated, which gave me some very good leads on the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank and the World Dope Trade, which I had not known before, and how the Bank of England financed the World Dope Trade. And of course, our Central Intelligence Agency. People wonder how the present President of the United States, George Bush, is involved with the World Dope Trade. He was chosen as director of the Central Intelligence Agency because of his family banking house connection with the Bank of England, which is the fount of the world drug trade. Now, Lyndon LaRouche was ridiculed in the world's press because he said that the Queen of England is the head of the world's drug trade. And, of course, he did say that. But what he meant was she was the symbolic figure because the Royal House of England is one of the principal stockholders of the Bank of England, and the British aristocracy, who are stockholders of the Bank of England, are the movers and shakers of the British Empire. And the fortunes of those stockholders not only were based on profits of the Bank of England, but also upon slavery. They dominated the slave trade for many years. Almost every British aristocrat had his own slave ship flying back and forth and selling slaves. And then when slavery was outlawed in the 1820s, they went into the world milk trade. And they found that even more profitable than the slave trade. So when you talk about the world intelligence agencies and the world financiers, you're talking about people who trafficked in human misery, who have made all of their profits from slavery, wars, dope, and just generally destroying other human beings. If you can call these people human beings, they're really satanic people, and they have a satanic operation. Yes?
Can you tell me the story behind how the activist Grant Farmer ended up incarcerated?
Yes, I wrote an article about that a few years ago. I don't have any copies with me. In fact, I want to get a book from my article now. That's one of the articles I want to put in there. Frances Farmer was probably the most prominent young actress, the most successful young actress on the Hollywood scene. And she began to object publicly to the fact that practically all of the people that she had to deal with, her agents, her producers, everybody, they were all communists in Washington. They were also Jewish, but she objected to them because they were communists. And after she began to voice these objections, she was suddenly arrested and put in a mental institution. She was brought here to Walla Walla. She was kept here for years. She was given lobotomy. She was given repeated shock treatments. And because she was a famous movie star, they brought over troops of soldiers, and the attendants sold